This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Troy Antic. Since the advent of the printing press, fake news has existed as a commercial strategy to sell more pamphlets and newspapers. How did we cope with fake news in the past and why has it become such a political hot potato today? Here to provide some answers is Gayatri Venkateswaran, an assistant professor who specializes in media reforms in Southeast Asia. Gayatri, welcome.
Thank you.
So, fake news as we know it today, is it something new? And if it is not, why has it become such a topic that we are grappling with? And if it's something new, then how did it come to be?
Okay, I think there are two parts to it. I guess we have been caught up with the terminology of fake news itself. But if we unpack it a little bit more, and this is where your question of history, right? Is it an old thing or a new thing? We have definitely seen that throughout the centuries in terms of the use or the abuse, even manipulation of information, often for those wanting to seek power, to maintain power, or to get an advantage or leverage over the others. So, I mean, this is something that is, I would say, part and parcel of that kind of political bargaining or even power bargaining. And so information has always been a very important currency in that sense. And it's not confined only to political spheres, but also you talk about how even businesses competing with each other make use of information. So, I mean, in that sense, if we sort of like remove all the other baggage that we have today already, this is a, I guess, a phenomenon that's quite typical in terms of competition, whether it's political or economic or even on a personal level. But I think today what we're looking at is particularly in the context of technology, digital technology, in which we are unable to really locate or verify information because it's moving at such a, you know, in that speed and the reach that it has, that for the sort of ordinary users of social media, digital technologies, we are receiving this information and possibly at levels that we are unable to comprehend. And you know, we are confronted with so many decisions and so many options in that sense. And I think that has played a role if we look in the context of elections in several countries where this phenomenon has actually had an impact, at least to maybe dislodge some of our own perceptions or reinforce certain perceptions. So I think I would just quickly wrap up that and say it's not a new thing, but what we see today is in the context of technology that has made the kind of misinformation or manipulation of information reach us way much faster and maybe propels us to think that we have to act on it. And I think that's where maybe some of the concerns that we see have arisen because we feel we are receiving all of this on our WhatsApp or our Facebook Messenger. Something is happening. We have to do something about it. And I think that's where the source of this new discussion has arisen.
Mm. Does that mean that because it's hard to verify, we believe it so readily? Why is it so hard to take that extra step to just, you know, ask where is this information coming from? Who's behind it? Who's is there an agenda behind the information that's being spread? Why are we so ready to believe? It's easy, I guess, if it confirms our bias. But if it doesn't, do we also believe it so readily?
Mm. I think over time, what we have seen is that the changes in way communications have taken place. So if you look at, you know, we can go back really, really far. We can start with the, you know, political communication pre-modern civilization in that sense. But, you know, the changes in communication tools and also the approach. So with the printing press, you had the kind of mass communication, the start of mass communication. Definitely radio reinforced or enhanced that. But today, of course, the kinds of communication are no longer one-to-one. We see that it's probably from many-to-many. And the kinds of interactions that happen is, you know, it's way much more complex than it used to be. So at we have seen in history, there have been those who have had the monopoly of information. And so the levels of gatekeeping and filtering much, much higher before. Now those elements have somewhat been shaken already or diluted because of the fact that you and I today can produce information, channel it through some of these digital platforms and maybe even get the kind of traction that a media can. Not always, but we have that possibility. And some people do have that kind of influence. So those changes in the way communication happens, I think, gives a sense of empowerment and also gives a sense of maybe a bit more ownership of the information that we produce and receive. But at the same time, I think people are not equally sort of like exposed or trained to think about how information is constructed and shared. So, you know, I mean, if we take the older media, you are trained to be a journalist, you have your editors, you know, you go through the ropes, you learn what goes out through the radio or what is not published. Mm-hmm. But today, that level of censorship, or I wouldn't say censorship, but gatekeeping, is sort of like maybe confined to those spaces, but not necessarily our day-to-day communication. So we are more susceptible to receiving information from those who have not gone through that gatekeeping process for some very good reasons as well. I think it's fine. But maybe we are not equipped. The lot of us are not equipped to actually think through those processes and what impact it could have on the information that we receive. So there are many communication sort of like theories that say, you know, we do look for information that supports our viewpoint. And I don't think that's a bad thing always, because we do need some kind of reinforcement of our own beliefs. But it can lead us to having very narrow viewpoints. Mm. And on the other hand, I think even if you don't believe it, I think that what I said earlier, you know, this urgency or sense of urgency that you have to do something about it because it's really coming directly to us. And I think that makes people or compels people to have to make that kind of decisions.
Yeah, and algorithms that social media has only exacerbate that problem, right, of giving you news that you already believe or are inclined to believe anyway. And this sense of empowerment that you talk about, that when social media was first used to mobilize and organize, I remember in 08 when it's all about Obama and hope and change. Mm-hmm. And in Malaysia, the opposition was calling it the tsunami, and it's largely led by a social media campaign as well. And Tahrir Square, of course. And now it seems like those in power or the government has caught up, yeah, and they are now using social media to their advantage. So in light of the fallout of Cambridge Analytica, mm-hmm. can we draw like a conclusive link that social media campaigns do lead to concrete, tangible results that are based on lies and deceit and misinformation?
I think there are two aspects to that. And one of it is that, taking that example that you've given, right, with Obama, with even with the Malaysian 2008 situation, I think given the Malaysian context for sure, and also maybe if we draw upon the context of the Arab Spring, I think very importantly we need to talk about the existing conditions in society that have maybe led to that possible impact of social media. So it wasn't the social media on its own, but the fact that there were some inadequacies or some problems with, I would say, credible information or access to information. So we have had a history of controlled environment for media as well as public information. And I think that is actually a key point to sort of like understand why and how the use of social media could be seen as having that impact to lead to some kind of mobilization or change. So, and I think in the context of Tahrir Square and things like that, it wasn't the main driver actually, but because there were forces in society or the frustrations in society and inequalities. I think inequality is really one of the main drivers of why technology has become so important. In the early years, women who were not able to have access to owning media found that technological spaces allowed ownership and also the production of content. So there is that inequality, I think, that is very important. The second part of it is that I think in terms of Cambridge Analytica's, expose in that sense, I think that element of corporate and political mix is also not a new thing. Mm. And we see in many societies where there has been that nexus and interest a vested agenda in terms of what you can gain. As I said earlier, why do you have this kind of misinformation? Because there's a sense of competition. There is that zero-sum game. I win, you lose. What can I use in order to win? So one is that inequalities that exist that has fueled many of us to look at social media as a platform. And secondly, I think it's that back to how corporate and political agendas actually do sort of come together.
Yeah. Whole departments are dedicated.
To,
yeah, to giving one account of any given issue. Let's take a break first. I'm speaking today to Gayatri Venkateswaran about the history of fake news. After the break, I'll ask her whether fake news is a problem in Malaysia and whether regulations is the way forward. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Troy Antek. My guest today is Gayatri Venkateswaran, an assistant professor who teaches political communication, propaganda, and public relations. We're talking about the history of fake news. Gayatri, is fake news a problem in Malaysia, or is this largely something we're talking about preemptively?
So if I were to make a submission, for example, if you know it was an open process, I would say that it is not a problem as we are made to understand and perceive it. Because if we take the definitions or the kind of examples given by the government, then those are other issues. And I would give some examples such as defamation, cyberbullying, and also sort of false information regarding products, services. Now, these are not fake news. These are quite specific actions that in fact are already covered under the law. And they are consumer interests, they are also the issues of reputation. And I was surprised that these were the examples cited when the law was actually tabled in Parliament, because you could easily say that, well, this is covered under the various laws for quite specific reasons. So if we use that as a reference, then I would say that there is no problem, because these are quite well-defined areas and where the remedies are also very much available. So if I can just refer to, in fact, the caretaker minister, Azalina, who tabled that law, and she talked about how people who are defamed can use these laws, the fake news law, anti-fake news law, the Communications Multimedia Act, Printing Presses Act. Now, if you are defamed, there's a defamation law. It's not the best. There are some problems with it. But why do you lump defamation with fake news? It's actually quite separate. Yeah. So I would say then, again, that the answer is no. But are there other problems that maybe we want to deal with if we take those examples? Cyberbullying is definitely a problem, but it cannot be part of the fake news narrative. Cyberbullying is about the exercise of power, the use of now technology in order to assert, to intimidate, to harass, that can have quite dire consequences. Yeah, worldwide, we have seen particularly young adults maybe also sort of resorting to suicide, for example. Yeah, but it is very different from this notion of, oh, it's false news. It's not. Cyberbullying is a very... Or bullying, yeah, if you look at bullying, there is that exercise of power. It is about wanting to harass someone to the point of being very, very submissive or sort of defeated in that sense, yeah. So you can't use this law to tackle that problem. It doesn't make sense. You need to understand the psychology. You need to understand interactions between people. And there should be other ways in which you address that problem. Yeah. Right. So I think some of the problems raised are genuine and legitimate. False advertising is a genuine problem. It is defined in not one but many laws so that consumers don't get cheated. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there is definitely a genuine concern. It's been in the law for many years actually already. So I think if we sort of break it down, we can say that there are genuine concerns. But I think those are not what the phrase fake news actually represents. We have seen already now the use of bots in the context of election campaign. That is also not fake news. It is algorithm. It is what do you call that?
Strategy.
Strategy, right? Mm-hmm. To confuse people. But that is in the context of election. So you also need to break it and say, okay, in election, maybe we have to think about how our elections are run. What's a do, what's a don't, you know? And maybe park it under election offenses tied to the party, right? Mm. So just at that level, I would say that they are legitimate concerns, but they have nothing to do with fake news. Mm. Yeah.
So what I gather is more regulation and legislation is not necessarily the answer. How would you define this problem of fake news then, if it's not false advertising, if it's not giving misleading information in an election?
Okay. So I also just want to reiterate that I think with the issues that I said are legitimate, some of it do require legislation. So, for example, like domestic violence as well, these forms of bullying do require some interventions. False advertising, consumer rights do require that. But what I would say we ought to be concerned about is how there is the use of information, there is the use of platforms to deliberately deceive audiences or voters in a very specific context, which could be elections. And I would say that there needs to be transparency, actually, on the part of parties, candidates, to show what methods that they are using. And I think online content that puts out information that is not only false, but it is deliberate, systematically, I think can be somehow thought of as a requirement under the election law to be declared, and maybe the actions can be under sort of that, you know, framework. Yeah. Yeah. So take it out of the others, because for me, I think this fake news law also captures those who have opinions about our political system that cannot be included, actually. You know, that's a violation of freedom of speech. So if people are putting out information to mislead, to misinform, to really, like, you know, give false information, that has to be already considered in the context of elections. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we do have the PPPA, which does contain that provision. Again, not my favorite law, but it is there, and it tackles also content spread online. So we have been very concerned that when you have this provision, why are you having another one that is not even as detailed as the PPPA, actually? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are there any examples of maybe clear-cut fake news incidences since perhaps G13?
So we have, it's a bit difficult to verify, again, because you need to have the resources to double-check whether the content is indeed false or and deliberately false. And that deliberate intent is a bit difficult to justify. But you could, I guess. I think that I don't think the level of the U.S. experience with the Macedonian websites putting out content that were pro-Trump and anti-Hillary, I don't think we have seen that yet. Now, a lot of what we have seen have been what I would classify as maybe rumors that are mainly spread on Facebook, not necessarily as websites. Or websites that look similar to a bank website that is intended to fish your data, right? Identity theft or things like that. I don't think we have in that idea of the Macedonian websites. Mm. Now, people, and I do agree to some extent, sometimes official content that we see on the media may very easily fit into this description that even the government is putting forward as fake news, because we are unable to actually verify that information that they put out because we don't have access to, say, the Freedom of Information Act, right? So how do we actually verify what people in power are saying are in fact true? And they say it consistently again and again. So I would throw the question back to them and say, are you guaranteeing us that your information is true? Can we cross-check your information as public and say, huh, you know, that indeed it is verified? So I don't think there are examples to the extent that the US has had. I think we are dealing with very gray area in which what we see on the media we need to question. But I think the focus has been a lot on rumors, and rumors need to be treated very differently as well.
Rumors. Yeah, okay, maybe I can get you to expand on that.
Yeah.
And also to the talk about this example of the Macedonian kids, teenagers who are churning out these articles that are pro-Trump and anti-Hillary, because their intention is not to deceive. Their intention is just to make a quick buck, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the algorithm are such that news that are pro-Trump and anti-Hillary drives the most traffic.
Mm-hmm.
So in those instances, they would not be considered as proponents of fake news because there's no intent. Is that right?
Well, I think that what we have seen in that case is that you are aware of the sort of, you have the temperature on the ground, which may be partly fueled also by the kind of Facebook, Twitter algorithm, right? So you can see that this is where certain things are going. And you take advantage of that information or mood and churn out certain content because you know that's what's going to get you the attention. Whether they were going to indeed influence the elections, again, I think that's definitely a question we can ask. But yeah, their main intention was to make money out of it. Yeah, but in the process, it's the elections that was affected, right?
Mm.
But I think they were taking advantage of what the temperature was. So, you know, in that sense, putting out what they thought people expected already. So, yeah, kind of it's an unclear relationship, but the motive was definitely to make money. And here, I think, you know, if I just want to talk about the rumors, we are a rumor-based society.
Mm.
Every election, you can flip any of the newspapers at least a month or two before the elections are called. The starting line in the article would be, rumor mills are at work again. We thrive on rumors because we don't have information. We thrive on rumors because it's part of our narrative building as well, our storytelling. So rumors on its own, yes, can be costly. But, you know, it's also somewhat part of our, what do you call that, bartering for some other position. We throw one rumor out to see what comes back, you know. So now we are criminalizing rumors without actually providing a clear sense of what the impact of those rumors are, you know.
Mm, yeah.
We tell stories all the time to each other, but because it's now on the digital platforms, it has a much wider reach. Then we get, we're panicked by it. Oh my God, is it really true? I think that in some cases, there were genuine concerns, like a possible epidemic of something and the health ministry coming out and saying, no, it's not true. And that is important for the health ministry to say, it's not true, clarify.
Yeah.
That is the role of the government.
Yep.
Yeah. So I think we should not really criminalize rumors because I think the situation there is that when it comes to political information, it comes as a result of the lack of information.
Yeah. So because there are hundreds of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of rumors being circulated every day, the government argument would be they can't possibly respond to all the rumors. What would you say to that?
So I think as a government, your duty is to provide information. And again, part of the reason some things are fueled as rumors is because people maybe don't have access to people in authority. It's very difficult to make your representation to certain authorities. It's not uncommon that people are turned away or don't get the chance to meet the officers in charge or whatever. And, you know, it has improved definitely over the years where there should be routine publication of information. You should put out information a lot more routinely. And that is a way of dispelling some of the concerns. Having a much better information management system, yeah, dedicated spokespersons and information officers who can provide that. So those are all provided for under the Freedom of Information framework. So I think there are real challenges for the public. And, you know, sometimes your MPs don't necessarily do that job for you or your ADUNs, right? So you also need a way of having that interaction. So we have seen in some countries, in some city council states where they have used social media as a way to encourage interaction between elected officials and the public for the sake of good governance.
Mm-hmm.
So you can always turn it and make it into a way of having that, conversations.
Right. Singapore has been trying to create or enact their anti-fake news bill too, and they have a very public hearing conducted by the Select Committee on Deliberate Online Falsehood. And also in Germany, since January, they already have this anti-hate speech law that is intended to rein in the hate speech on social media. What do you think of where this trajectory is going in both instances?
I think the context for Germany is very interesting in the sense that both Germany and France, a lot more of these discussions came, particularly after the wave of the new wave of refugees coming into Europe, primarily from Syria. So there was this, you know, sort of mixed reactions towards refugees. On the one hand, welcoming and saying that, you know, this is our obligation, but also sections of the population who were very resistant towards that. And so there were instances where the kind of anti-immigration, you know, very specifically anti-Muslim rhetorics were fueled and stepped up. And if you look at the elections, candidates had taken advantage of that to be elected. So Marie Le Pen, for example, yeah. So there's a context, and Germany is a country that has very strong and stringent regulation against hate speech because of its history, one of the more stricter regimes compared to many other countries. So they are coming from, in a way, point where they need to defend minorities. So hate speech should not be tolerated, which I think is a very noble thing. And in fact, hate speech is it's one of those sort of areas of speech that can be criminalized and ought to be, especially when you are inciting hatred and violence against groups of people. Yeah. Mm. So that is the context partly. And of course, Germany has also taken a very strong position, like in Europe, many of European countries, on the issue of data protection and privacy. So you can see that the direction that they're heading is to... It's a combination of areas, yeah? Not just to say, oh, we're going to ban hate speech or whatever, but we also take privacy very seriously and data protection very seriously. So if you do want to have a legal regime, you also need to make sure that protections are in place. And it's protection of minorities, not majority. Right, yeah, that's right. Very important to highlight. And so when we talk about speech that can incite violence, we need to see who's perpetrating all of this and who's going to be protected.
Yeah.
So that's in Germany's context.
Yeah. Before you go to Singapore, what about this notion that just by banning speech, you are not actually contesting or refuting the ideas, and these ideas are still there. If left unaddressed, it just go to someplace else. Maybe it's encrypted, maybe it's unseen by the authorities, and you still have this sense of unsatisfaction or resentment towards immigrant population or minority population. How would such an approach of clamping down on hate speech deal with such an issue?
So in the context of Germany, they, there's been a lot of resistance as well, both Germany, France, from civil society and media to say you cannot do a blanket ban. And I don't think that's the intention. I think it's really trying to get the social media companies to take down pages or content that they feel, you know, fit that sort of hate speech criteria. But again, that's not the easiest thing to do. So, but firstly, saying that there is a much stronger protection for freedom of expression. So that balancing will always happen. And they have had many cases in which they test that those balances, the different rights. Not mutually exclusive, but to see how you ought to protect freedom as well, because you rightly say that you need to have some levels of discussion and not to completely keep it out of the public sphere. But at the same time, weighing one against the other and seeing what is the public interest, really. Mm. And so that those countries have seen a lot more test cases and in the past and also hoping to test it. Mm. And I think that's what is missing in our context, that we have a very weak freedom of expression protection.
Right. Yeah. Singapore has used public interest as their form of argument that in order to maintain their multiracial harmony. What do you think about their approach?
I think they have to be commended for one thing. They had this open select committee hearing, which is really good because they allowed for different groups, stakeholders, to make presentations. But if you look at the context that the law that they're thinking about is deliberate online falsehoods. But in the course of the discussions, you also see pulling in this idea of racial harmony, right? So I think, and cyberbullying also. Again, cyberbullying comes up as a key concern. To me, they are quite separate issues. But you can get a sense from them as well that they are rightfully concerned about certain kinds of, ethnic-based comments and hatred. But, you know, to put everything and say that if we cure it online, therefore the problem is gone, I think it's problematic. So it was good that there were some groups that went and said, look, you can't solve everything with the law. You need to have the kinds of literacy discussions, inter-ethnic group discussions, other sort of interventions. But one point was that there are some things that require court orders. And to have court orders, you need some legislative framework. And that's what their argument is. If we want to take down content, we need to have court orders. So we need to have that legal backing. But whether you need a new law or not, maybe that's not maybe it's not necessary. You may need to tweak some of the existing ones.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to things like cyberbullying, maybe you actually need something that is quite targeted towards that, or a harmony bill or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know. So I think they're also including some of the other things we have seen here. But I think they have attempted to at least get much wider inputs. And, you know, they grilled the social media companies, which was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Because then we saw Mark Zuckerberg in the US being grilled. And I think that it really showed how the social media companies, large corporations, are so not used to being held accountable.
Mm.
So I think that was actually a very good insight for us as well.
Yeah, because their main stakeholder so far has been to their profits.
Mm.
It hasn't been to public interest.
Yeah.
So I guess my final question would be, as we head towards G14, what is your advice to us on how we separate fact from fiction? How do we improve our media literacy?
So I think with election itself, it's very emotional. We tend to be very emotional. So to deny that it's an emotional experience is maybe not fair. But as someone who's receiving information or sharing, we talk about very simple things you can do. For example, just rechecking where, if you can see the source of information. That's always the first step. And not to immediately share content. In that sense, I kind of agree with MCMC. Say, don't share immediately, but I don't agree with why they are saying it. But, you know, just being a little bit more vigilant about why someone is sharing something with you. And that it's very possible, given the tools that we have online, to, of course, change pictures, modify, you know, create videos, superimpose, that always just have a kind of a critical mind to it. And that there is a distinction between news content and, say, phrases and sentences being shared by people as opinions. There's a likelihood you can go to the news content and actually trace maybe where they have got the information. Much more difficult with opinions. So you just need to be able to distinguish that, what is news and what is opinion. But always have a critical mind of whatever you are accessing. But also not to cut yourself out from getting information. Because as I said, you know, elections, it's very emotional.
Yeah.
But try to have an open mind about what you are reading and what you are watching on TV and stuff.
Thank you very much for speaking to me today.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Live and Learn. If you miss any part of this conversation, you can download the podcast via our BFM app, available now on Google Play and the App Store. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.